Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is Pat Prescott, and we're continuing our celebration of Black History Month as we honor individuals who are making waves in Southern California. And I got one of them in the studio with me right now. It is a privilege to bring to our studios one of the stars of CBS Daytime Emmy Award-winning talk show, The Talk, and she knows how to talk. She's a comedian, an actress, and a very interesting person with a wonderful life full of great accomplishments. And that is why we are honoring my good friend Cheryl Underwood. Hi, Cheryl.
Thank you. And you know what? It's just amazing to be here with Pat Prescott. You know, all of us girls that are trying to be in radio and trying to be announcers, we're like, I want to be Pat Prescott.
Well. Well, let me just say that, you know, I've been a fan of yours for a really long time. I had the chance to meet you last year, and we connected right away.
Yes.
We've been looking at you and watching all the great things that you've been doing. Mm-hmm. And we want to talk today just about your life and how you got here to where you are today. Mm-hmm. So let's start from the beginning. Tell us about where you were born and how you grew up and, you know, some of the influence of your parents, grandparents, people like that.
Born in Arkansas, raised in Chicago, Omaha, Nebraska, San Joaquin Valley, and then found my way to Los Angeles. But as a baby, I didn't realize how young my father was. My father was in his early 20s when I was born. Mm-hmm. So he was a young man. And my mother, very sassy, you know, she's, you know, straight up Arkansas woman, jet black wavy hair. She had a go-to front of mouth, popper gum, you know. So some of my personality is my mother, and most of my personality is my father. My father was like very conservative, but he was very progressive in thought, but very conservative about certain things, like women shouldn't be out drinking, especially by themselves, you know, things like that. And
yeah, the old Southern
way. Yeah, the old Southern way. Like, we didn't eat before my father ate.
The biggest piece of chicken.
And the middle piece of cornbread with all the butter on it. Yes. Yeah. Even to this day, when I got married, I didn't eat before my husband ate. And it took me a long time to get used to that because my mother was so independent.
Right.
But now I don't eat before my brothers eat. And they think that's a hoot. They think that's funny.
Well, way we're socialized, I mean, it makes a difference. I mean, we're losing a lot of those kind of sensibilities because mm-hmm. no one is teaching anybody anything. Manners, right. You know, teaching the young boys to pull out of chairs,
yes.
Walk on the side,
yes.
On the street side,
yes.
You know.
Yes. And see, I was blessed to have two mothers. I had my mother that gave birth to me, in which our relationship was very estranged. And then I had my stepmom who was...
She was your bonus mom.
Yes. And Southern Belle and... you always have to have a new dress for church, and my dad willingly wanted her to have a new dress for church. But also, she was the female part. You know, if you don't grow up with a sister or a mother that's wearing pearls and jewelry and high heels and things like that, you're not going to learn that. You know, because my dad called me his son because I was his firstborn, you know, and I kept telling him I'm a girl, but I didn't feel so girl. I like baseball. You know, I wanted to do everything my dad did. I wanted to be around my dad. But my stepmother, which I don't like calling her my stepmother because she raised me the rest of the way in my life. But then I was also blessed that my mother's mother, who I affectionately now call the enforcer, because every time my mother wanted to discipline me, which, remember, we had this estranged relationship and we weren't as close as I would want to be. But every time she tried to discipline me, I would call my grandmother. And when we lived in Omaha, my grandmother, she was a block away. Mm-hmm. And she always seemed to get there just in time. And I would just run behind her and point at my mom and go, "Yo, mama said, leave me alone." That's why I call her the enforcer, you know. But my grandmother taught me things like baking cakes. And but she also, after my grandfather and my grandmother were no longer together, I never saw her around any other man. And she would always say, well, you know, grandma got a boyfriend. Y'all just don't need to see him. But I never saw her around any other man. So when I got married and my husband died, you know, I've been a widow for a while. You just don't see me around men because of that example of my grandmother, mm-hmm. you know. So, and I had great, you know, my aunts, uncles, cousins, you know, I have great family members. I'm not as close to them as I should be because I'm kind of, I'm more like my dad. Mm-hmm. I'm reserved. I'm quiet.
That sounds funny coming from you, but
isn't that weird? It's weird. Yes. My uncle Leonard was the best joke teller and my brother Michael, great joke tellers. So I would kind of study them or watch them. Mm-hmm. And my dad was the best storyteller in the world. So that humor was always in the house. But to be a stand-up comic, it was something unusual, even though there was humor and laughter always, even in great tragedy.
Yeah. Were you a good student? Were you into school?
Oh, I loved school because school was my refuge, you know, of the things that were happening to me, molestations, the, you know, situations of, you know, domestic violence or my mother not being as close to me. So, you know, I thought, you know, she loved everybody else, but there was a distance to me that I now think is from postpartum depression, especially you don't hear that about black women.
Right.
Right. So I think my mother may have been suffering from that because I just learned a story recently from one of my cousins that said, you know, your mother brought you, and we used to call my grandmother either Big Mama, mm-hmm. You know, as Little Mama and Big mm-hmm. Mama, to Big Mama in a box. And I had always heard this story that I was so small as a baby because I used to have a twin sister. And there was two of us, and we were really, really small. We were born, but my twin sister didn't live. And that I had to sleep in the dresser drawer. Because I was so little.
Yeah,
and I remember
so
hearing,
fall out.
Yeah, hearing those stories. Mm-hmm. And then when she said, you know, she brought you in a box and just handed you over to her. And it kind of, you know, how you hear stuff and most people go, oh my God, it's so tragic. For me, it was validation. I always felt different than everybody else, you know? So school was my thing. I loved going to school. The only thing I didn't like about going to school was I was always taking care of my older sister who was disabled. So my older mm-hmm. sister, the oldest of our family on my mother's side, has the mental capacity of between 18 and maybe 24 months baby. Mm-hmm. But she's in her mid-60s now. So when I was little, you know how you had to do your chores.
Exactly.
I did a lot of housework, a lot of chores. I had to grow up really, really fast. But I was always very protective because my sister couldn't read, write, or talk. It's like having a baby
exactly.
in the body of a grown
that
woman.
That you're responsible for.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of adapted to it. But I was always worried about going to school because I was always worried, what if something happens to her? What if, you know, she can't talk to anybody? Mm-hmm. So, and my brother, Michael, came on the talk and he said that he felt like she and I had a way of communicating with each other that nobody else had.
Yeah.
And that he was jealous of the closeness that we still have to this day.
So when did you know that you wanted to be a comic? I mean, what were your aspirations like when you were in high school?
Well, I would say as far back as elementary school, because I was taking care of my sister, I was always in the house. My sister loved music, so we always had a radio on. So we were always listening to radio. And if we were living in Chicago, you know, you had great radio in Chicago.
Oh, no question.
Great black radio. Then when we moved to Omaha, you know, AM radio, KOIL. You know, great radio, you know, but we were listening to a lot of classic rock and stuff like that. So the radio was always on. The only time the radio was off when it was time for us to go to bed. So me taking care of my sister, I was always listening to the radio. And because I was always in the house with her, I was always watching TV. So I knew I wanted to do something that was either radio or television. I wanted to be in this business because also of the sadness of my life, that was the happiest times. And then I would watch people and go, I want to do that. So if you would see, like, I remember seeing Diane Carroll and Julia and then seeing her on the variety shows and going, I want to be that. I want to be that. I want to be Lola Falana, especially when she was dating Wanda Tavares. I was like, I want to be that.
Especially then.
Yeah. I don't want to be Paula Kelly. You know, so you're looking at these great female stars. And I was like, I want to be that. And I want to make people happy. And no matter how sad I was, I wanted to be that. But I also wanted to be a good student because my dad was always like, get an education. They can't take an education from you. So my whole life was to have some type of career, and I wanted to be in the entertainment business. And then I was like, maybe I'm not sure about a talk show, Dinah Shore, Mike Douglas. I remember the first time seeing Whitney Houston on Merv Griffin. I was more looking at Merv Griffin because I started as a singer and a dancer. But you know, if you're a black singer, you better be able to sing with an A. You know, so
the, with two
so
A's.
And I always wanted to be in the entertainment business, and I want to have a regular life. And then I want to be able to have my entertainment life. I want to be able to come home to my family and take care of my sister, you know. So I always felt a sense of responsibility. And then how I got into comedy is because singing wasn't working. Dancing wasn't working. I'm not tall enough. I'm not, you know, lean enough, you know. And somehow, I don't know how I kind of lucked up. It was really in school, in high school. I transferred to Atwater High. Mm-hmm. And in California, because my mother and father got divorced, and my mother married a man who was stationed at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska. Mm-hmm. He got orders to Castle Air Force Base, which took us to Atwater, California. And so I was like, California, this is okay. This is my chance. This is God putting it all together for me. And I remember telling these jokes. And my principal, Mr. C.J. Groves, and I remember him telling me, you are talented. Don't you let these kids pull you down the road of telling blue jokes, which I was like, I want to do. He understand I'm writing these jokes myself. And then I became rally commissioner at Atwater High. And the rallies, we weren't the greatest athletic team because Merced was always beating us. Anybody know Merced College? Merced, where Merced, California is, they were always beating us. So nobody was coming to the rallies, maybe 10, 15 people. Mm-hmm. So when I took over, I just made them like TV shows. They had, I did comedy in them. We dressed up. We did sketches. We had performers. Next thing you know, 400 or 500 people were getting up to come to school at 7 o'clock in the morning to come to the rallies because we just made them fun. And that's when I knew I could do something.
Well, it's one thing to be able to do that and a completely different thing, mm-hmm. being able to make a living of it.
Absolutely.
And just what I know of you, I see someone who is smart. And, you know, as George Wallace says, I'd be thinking mm-hmm. all the time, mm-hmm. figuring it out. Mm-hmm. What did you figure out was going to be your path at that time? What were your next steps going to be?
Well, I definitely wanted to go to college. So I started at Merced College, and then I transferred to Fresno City College, and then I got my associate's degree. And then I said, well, I want to get to know my dad, because I wasn't living with my father, mm-hmm. but it was something that was calling me to go, you need to get to know him before something happens. So then I transferred to University of Illinois, Chicago, and it allowed me to live with my dad. And I remember my dad telling me, I don't have money for you to live in the dorms, but I have a bedroom, you know, and you stay here. And I was like, okay, that sounds pretty good. And it was the best thing I could have ever done, because it kind of gave me a safety net, you know? Mm-hmm. I didn't have to work it out so fast. And it was, you know, to be able to do my homework and see my dad go, how's the paper coming? And I'm like...
And you're living with somebody who is the main person that drove that into
yes.
your head, that I have to do this. So I'm sure he yeah. was proud of you and supported you in that.
Oh my God, when I gave the student response, the salutatorian at UIC from graduation, my dad was beaming and over the moon. And yes, he was always proud of me, and he would tell me that. That was the one thing that I cherished, that he would always say how proud he was. He didn't really understand when I became a stand-up comic. But he didn't say anything against it, even though some people say that he spoke to them about his disappointment. But I went into the Air Force Reserve. That's where I met my husband. Well, I was on Castle Air Force Base. Then I met him. Then I was already going to go into the Air Force Reserve because I wanted to serve my country, because I saw these pictures of my father and my uncles, his brothers, and all of them had their military outfits on. So I was like, okay, I definitely want to do that. I definitely want to go to college. So I was already doing those things. And I wanted to make my father proud. And he always pushed me to do things. He said, listen, your brain was made by the same God that made the genius brain, the wealthy person brain, anybody else's brain. But he was always that person that was, he would never let you know if he was too disappointed unless it was something so bad that he had to sit you down. If my dad ever sat down with you and opened his Bible, you're in big trouble. You know, and rarely did that happen to me. But I was doing adult comedy, and I remember when my dad gave his life to Christ, and he promised God that he would never go into a tavern, you know, and that's where I was working, in taverns. But when he saw me on TV, he knew that I was doing adult material, because I told him when I was going to be on Def Comedy Jam. I remember the day that I called him. We had missed the audition at the Peppermint Lounge in New Jersey. I called him and I said, Daddy, do we have any relatives in New York or New Jersey? He said, why? I said, I've missed this audition by an hour. Club closed at 1 a.m. Me and a friend, Andre, had drove from Los Angeles to New York. And I think we took about 2 days, maybe, driving nonstop. And we missed the audition for Def Comedy Jam by an hour. Club closed at 1, got there at 2. So I asked, and my dad said, oh, your cousin Ernest Lee and Tina, his wife, you know, my cousins, lived there. And they lived in one of them co-op things. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, ooh, this is nice. Okay. And my cousin Baby Doll, who's in radio, and he was working at Hush. Remember
Melba Moore's? Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so they took me to the Peppermint Lounge for the next audition. And when I called my father and I said, I'm going to be on TV telling jokes. And he go, what kind of jokes? I said, adult jokes. And I remember my stepmother was on the other phone, you know, when they on both the phones. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, what you want to tell me? I said, I just want to ask, is it okay, you know, with the church and everything? I said, because I'm going to use the Underwood name. And he was like, are you good at it? I said, I think I'm one of the best adult comics. He said, okay, long as you're good at it. He said, what does the church folks got to do? They don't watch that type of show. So,
they'll never know. That was before social media, though.
Absolutely. But I will tell you, this is when my dad, and I didn't know this story until after he died. Remember, there was a war on drugs before there was a war on terrorism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the 90s, the late 80s and the 90s, we were flying on buddy passes. We were getting to the gig the best way we could. And so people were getting pulled off planes because you might fly in on a one-way ticket and back on a buddy pass, or you were doing things that looked like, you know.
Well, you could have been involved in the drug trade.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And I remember being very nervous because I was out here working at UCLA trying to get a paralegal certificate. So I was always nervous of how could the law be used against me, you know. And so I would carry my contracts and everything. So one time we got paid in cash. Woo, child. You talking about, you know.
And that's another thing that makes you look like a drug dealer.
That's right. And you know that money counter thing in the bank? So it's like that. So you get paid in cash and it's all the bills that somebody done ironed out and all kind of crazy stuff. So I was like, if they confiscate this money, they can hold it or they may not ever give it back to me. So I was flying back to Los Angeles after doing a gig. And I thought, if I go through Chicago, I can have my dad wire it to me so that I don't get pulled off the plane where they come, because I really need to pay my bills. So I went and I called my dad. I said, Dad, I need to come through Chicago. I need you to do me a favor. And he was like, what? I said, I need you to wire this money that I just made. So he's like, oh, Daddy, yeah, I know everybody at the bank. You know, black man, I know everybody at the bank. I know parking people. I know everybody at the bank. Come on down. Daddy got a bank account down at the bank. I said, okay. So I go in there. Now, you got to picture me as a guy, because me and my daddy look alike, talk alike, act alike. So my daddy walking in, shaking hands. You know, black man got to shake hands, talk to everybody at the bank before we get to. My daughter need me to wire her little money that she done made doing comedy, right? So we get in there, and in the little customer service area, they take us into another room. And my daddy go, give the lady the money that you want me to wire. So I pull out this dookie brick, like from the 70s, big stack of money, about $15,000. And my dad looked like you just looked. Where you get that money from? I said, I made it. Doing what? Comedy. For how long? 45 minutes. He said, just one time? I said, yes, sir. You know, and I showed him the contract, and I showed him this is how much I get paid to do this. So they counted the money, and they, you know, marketed it to make sure nothing was counterfeit.
Exactly.
And he transferred it to me. What I didn't know is after my father died, you know how they clean out the bedroom? Under the lace runner was the deposit slip, and that he would take it out and gaze at it with pride that his daughter was making enough money to take care of herself.
Telling adult jokes.
Yes, yes, yes. And he had never seen, well, he saw a couple of things on TV, but he never seen me live. And I'm kind of happy about that because I was raised to honor God before self.
Yeah.
So that I really appreciate it. That.
So that Deaf Comedy Jam gig was the one that really, I think, introduced a whole lot of people to you.
Yeah.
And fast forward to today, I mean, you know, you've done movies, you've done television, you've done all kinds of things. But I was really happy to see when you got signed on to The Talk.
Wow.
You know, and I want you to tell the story of how that whole thing happened and how your life has changed since then.
Well, I will say that, you know, I felt the comedians that we loved, Moms Mabley, Whoopi Goldberg, Marsha Warfield, Red Fox, Pig Meek Markham, even Dick Gregory had adultness and a little political to it and a little spirituality to it. So I was looking at who do we love? Even Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor. Okay, so I know who we love. So I'm going to start adult because I watched them and they started adult, but they can clean it up, right? So I was like, okay, let me master this. And I thought it took a great brain to master adult comedy because it's already been done.
Right.
So here I am trying to master that, get on Deaf Comedy Jam. And there are two Sheryl Underwoods. There's the married Sheryl Underwood that's been doing comedy in Chicago, right? And then there's Sheryl Underwood, my maiden name. So they think it's two different people coming out doing this, but it's one person. So by the time I get to Deaf Comedy Jam, and that's the buzz, but also that's the block. It's a buzz. This girl do comedy just like a dude, and she's funny, but she's dirty. So we're not going to let her do this. We're going to go get somebody else, right? So I had to polish my skill. And then I wanted to be able to add some political because I loved Dick Gregory and I loved Mort Saul and, you know, and I loved the comedy of Mitch Hedberg. So I was studying all comics. Oh, my God. Wanted to marry him. Listen to me.
Talk about gone too soon.
Oh, my God. And I was so hurt because he used to send me messages like, I like this joke that you tell. I was like, oh, Mitch Hedberg like me. He know me. You know, and then you had a fantasy of being Sheryl Hedberg. And it's, like, it's not going to happen for you. But when he passed, I was distraught. It was like my man had died and we weren't around each other because we weren't in those same circles. But even in my career, to be able to add politics to adult humor and then get the call from Jamie Foxx and Marcus King to say, hey, we want you to do this thing called Laugh-a-Palooza. Right. And it was right after September 11th. And I had been doing some really hardcore pro-American, and I'm a Republican, and I'm pro-President George Bush, and people are like, we ain't doing that right now, but but before September 11th.
Right.
Then after September 11th, everybody's like, okay, he all right. So Jamie Foxx said, and Marcus King said, come do Laugh-a-Palooza. So I'm watching everybody do their set, and they're all doing club material. And I'm like, Jamie, I'm going to bomb. And he's like, what do you mean you're going to bomb? I'm like, I'm about to do a hardcore political set of pro-Bush material in Atlanta. I said, I'm going to bomb.
That sounds like suicide.
Yeah. And then I hear Jamie tell the cameraman, film everything she says. And that was one of my proudest moments because they knew better than I did, but I had to trust my own instinct to do the set, to polish the material, and it was difficult. Mike Washington and I, well, he's my feature act, been my feature act for years. We were traveling around the country and doing this material, and I remember being in Cleveland, and this white couple comes to us in tears, and I think I've offended them. And the man says he was one of the air traffic controllers that was trying to guide in United Flight 93.
Yeah.
So I'm saying all of this to say, sometimes there's a reason for this. So, and I believe that in starting in club life, you know, is any nightclub that'll put together a comedy show and you do that. Then moving on to do Carolina West and Comedy Act Theater out here, right?
That's a whole interview of its own.
Yes. And then to be able to do back when it was called Universal Amphitheater. Okay, and be able to do Midsummer Night Magic, you know, when Magic Johnson was doing his thing.
Right.
That lets you know, okay, you are going in the right direction and you got to know what material to do when. So by the time I get to a point, and I'm also in a sorority. So I have this duality of finer womanhood up against this street language that I feel makes the connection to some intellectual humor, right? So then I get to a point where I'm respected. I'm not making a lot of money. I'm not on the TV shows. I'm not making movies. I'm not like the queens of comedy or anybody like that. But then I got to keep trusting God and trying to better myself so God will see that I'm ready. And then I start getting these phone calls from somebody saying they from CBS. And I don't believe it. I believe it's my friends at comedy playing on my phone. So I'm calling everybody, cussing everybody out. You play too much. Stop pretending to be a white man calling me from CBS. Steve Harvey goes, it might be CBS. You might want to see who it is. And in 4 days, I had a job that I have to this day.
Wow. And that's amazing. And how long is it now?
This is my 9th season. The show's been on for 10 seasons. I came in season 2. I think that God puts you where he needs you to be. I like being on the number one network, CBS. I like being on radio. I like being able to meet people. Like, you know, if we weren't coming together for Taste of Soul, and when we did those promos, you would have thought we'd been friends for years. I think we need to do the Pat and Cheryl, you know, like Laverne and Shirley. And
I don't see why not.
Then why not? We just need 2 more people. Okay. To be Pat and Pat, you, Pat Harvey,
oh yeah,
and then me and Lonnie Love.
Oh, I love,
and we'll
love,
be the
Lonnie
we'll
love.
Be the Golden Girls. Wouldn't it be? Ooh, okay, we keep this a secret. That would be really, really cool. But that's the thing that I want to get into, and being at CBS, I've been allowed to do things and advance my career, but also I've been allowed to use it as a platform.
Exactly. And you do have a platform to do. You have something to offer on your platform. I mean, first of all, I'm so proud of you for all your accomplishments. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've done so much. You know, your Emmy.
Oh, my gosh.
Your first time Emmy.
And couldn't believe that they would allow me to host multiple years and then to win one and an NAACP award.
Yes, I'm sure you're proud of that, too.
Oh, very
but
much
what
so.
I love about you, though, Cheryl, is the great work that you do in the community and how you reach out and want to help people and help lift up others. Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about that.
I will tell you this. Being able to sit across from Dionne Warwick, who is my sorority sister in Zeta Phi Beta, and to be able to hand her a gift that she opens on the show and puts on the Zeta bracelet and the Zeta pin. It's a Z5B pin with pearls. I just think it's a connection between show business and service to the community. And that really made me feel you're looking at this the right way. It's not just about making money. It's about when God blesses you with something, how are you going to pass that blessing on? And being able to do events like Taste of Soul and being able to work with Zeta Phi Beta Sorority Incorporated and to be an entertainer, to go on to be his 23rd international president. I mean, nobody would think that those things would happen for a little girl in Arkansas. And then to now say, we are going to use this platform, these connections between you and I, this power to say, listen, we need people to vote. We need you to not just register people, but you're going to have to physically get people to vote now. We need you to fill out your census form to be able to say people listen to what I say, Cheryl Underwood, that they're going to fill out their census form. 9 short questions. You fill out more information to get a Facebook page.
That's
but
true.
To be able to impart that to somebody and then to be able to historically recreate the 1963 March on Washington, because it's time for people to coalesce together to say we can save and protect this democracy one vote at a time. And we're going to do it in a time period that I think people will respect Congressional Black Caucus weekend.
You know, you've done a lot and you have a lot planned. You have a lot that's on your plate right now. But as you look back at your career this far and your life in general, what are you most proud of?
To be able to take care of my sister. I mean, there are things that I invest my money in, radio production, development of TV programs, because everybody needs content. But until you sell one, you're just investing in things. You know how this business is. But the first check I write is for my sister that had 24-hour care to protect her privacy. I think it's a blessing from God. And most people would say, well, why don't you just stop doing all of that? Well, what happens if the talk goes away? What happens if I can't travel like I'm doing with stand-up comedy? And then I can't help students get to college, HBCU students that really need our help, kids in community college that don't believe that they can do what I did. So if you want to say what I'm proudest of, one, to be able to take care of my sister. Two, to be able to help people realize their dreams because somebody helped me realize mine. And three, to stay out of trouble. The same.
And you've done a pretty good job of
right.
that.
Right. You don't hear much about me.
Never hear anything bad about you.
No, no. And I think that's a testament of my dad. You don't want people talking bad about you. You want people talking good about you, you know. And I would say proudest to be an example for not just other women, but there are men that respect my achievement and the things that I've done. And I hope that I stay level-headed and stay focused. And I hope that when God says, okay, you handled these blessings that I kept giving you, now this bigger blessing is coming. You're ready, servant.
Well, I got one more question to ask you, and this is a two-part question.
Okay, but don't forget about our sitcom.
I'm
play yourself.
I'm taking notes.
You play yourself.
What are you talking about? That's the only way I can do it.
That's right. Me either. It's a reality show sitcom.
I have to be a DJ. Yeah, I have to do that whole thing.
Don't you think that would be so cool?
That could be cool.
Me, you, Lonnie Love, and Pat Harvey. Stop playing.
We're recording this.
That's recording. This is a contract. It's a contract.
But I wanted to ask you this. Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, when you look back, is there, what is the best advice that anybody has given you in your life? And what is a bit of advice that you wish somebody had given you?
It's the same. Put God first and everything else falls into place. When you put God first, you won't do certain things, not just to yourself, but to other people. My dad always said, ask people for forgiveness before the sun go down because tomorrow's not promised to you. Look at the situation with Kobe.
Yeah.
I think people need to face. Yes, death is a part of life, but you can be a better person if God lets your eyes open one more day. So for me, the best advice was to be a good person, because people say, well, fame and money changes you. No, it doesn't. I think all it does is illuminate the good and the bad of you. A lot of famous people that got money that shouldn't have it because look what it did to them. But then it's a lot of famous people that handle money really, really well and do something for other people. I want to be that person.
I think you are. And it's for that and so many other things that we honor you during this Black History Month. And we pray for you. And our biggest wish is that, you know, you will continue to grow and continue to prosper and continue to share all those blessings with everybody else. And we know you're going to do that.
Thank you.
And we're going to make a TV show.
Absolutely. And play ourselves.
Cheryl Underwood, she is making waves, and I think she's going to do that forever. Congratulations.
Thank you.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.